Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hope everybody's doing well today. I want to welcome everybody to the Unimpressed Podcast. And today we have a friend calling in from Malibu, California. It seems like all the stunt people are in Malibu for some reason. And his name is Fred North. He's got a book out called Flying Sideways. Welcome to the show, Fred. How are you doing today?
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. All good. Thank you.
So you ended up in L.A. You grew up in Africa?
Yes.
And you ended up in L.A. What do you think about that transition, thinking about that as a kid till now?
I mean, if it would have been overnight, it would have been a shock. But there's a 350-page explaining the transition. But I mean, at the end of the day, I think anything is possible. You know, it was never my intent to really, you know, live in L.A. at the end. But I'm super happy that, you know, I've done that. And, you know, it's the same planet, so not a problem.
So when you talk about personality, is there a personality that resembles a stuntman's personality?
Yes, I think so. You have two sort of personality as far as doing action things or a job that require outside skill. So you have people that dealing with decision-making process and anything you do in your life with their instinct. So you're more like an instinctive person, which means, you know, you have a gut feeling that's right, but there is no, you didn't think about it too much. You didn't do a business plan. You just know it's good. Okay. So I'm more that kind of person, and any stunt person will be a little bit like that. He knows it's going to be fine. It doesn't mean he's not going to back it up with data and numbers and stuff, but his first feeling and decision is 99.9% right. And I think that's what the stunt, you know, people that are more technical, and those people need to have a protocol, need to have a plan, they need to check the data, and then they make a decision.
Gotcha. I've talked to a couple of jet pilots, and I would think, you know, being a jet pilot would have to have the same type of skill as someone like you, and almost have no fear in a way. You think that's true?
I mean, the fear, we do have fear. If you don't have fear, you know, you'll kill yourself. So yes, we do have fear. It's just that you manage the fear. Personally, even after, you know, my 21,000 hours of helicopter, I still have fear. But I manage, it's more like a risk management that I do better than back in the day. I think all the stunts are the same. They, you know, just before I do a stunt and I do a difficult sequence, I do have, you know, my stomach, I have, you know, a knot in my stomach. I feel the pressure, mm-hmm. and that's fear. But I do manage it better than back in the day. So yeah, I think we have maybe even more fear than people don't do any stunt.
Uh-huh. You know? What did mom and dad do?
They were teachers, French teachers. That's why we were in Africa, because the French government, because school in France is mandatory until you're 16 years old. So even if you're a French guy living in Africa, you need to go to school. So they have those French lycées that you find everywhere on the planet. Mm-hmm. And the French government sent people. So my parents were one of them.
You in, or what town were you in Africa?
So I was born and raised in Tunisia, but only stayed 1 year there. Then I went to Senegal, which is west side of Africa. And I stayed in Saint-Louis in Senegal, which is north of Dakar, which is the main town in Senegal, just mm-hmm. under the Mauritania border. It's really the west side of Africa, really that big country there. And I stayed 13 years there, and it was awesome. I mean, I've, you know, blessed to have my childhood over there. And then we went to Ethiopia on the east side in Addis Ababa, which is the main town in Ethiopia. That was more tricky because it was during the war. There were 4 years of war zone, so it was a little bit tricky for us. And then I went to Germany, to Munich, to where my parents transferred. So all over the place.
I mean, what is that like as a kid, you know, growing up in Africa and you have some conflict and so forth? Is it really as bad as what people say it is?
For me, it was not bad at all. First of all, you know, Tunisia and Senegal, back then there was peace. So the thing with West Africa is people have happy in general, like they go day by day. And that was fantastic. I mean, all my buddies, you know, like in my class, we were like 40 kids. I was the only white guy. And mm-hmm. it was amazing. I mean, there was friendship and there was no racist word in our language. It didn't exist. Mm-hmm. It was just brotherhood. And for me, it was fantastic time. I only remember good stuff on it. So I know today that, you know, the world is a little bit different, but there's more hate and things like that. I think one of the reasons is because back then we didn't have no phone, no iPhone, no internet, no nothing. So people, I think, were living more the moment versus now you read all that stuff and then people have opinion and judgment. And then, I don't know, it may just be one of the explanations.
Well, I have this thing called pocket narratives. And I think whoever the powers may be put these pocket narratives out in society that creates issues, and it drives that information, drives people a certain way. And we're so stupid, we don't realize that. So probably because y'all were brothers over there, because you didn't have the pocket narrative driving people the wrong direction.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Back then, there were no fake news or whatever you want to call it. And then it was easy.
Yeah.
It was easy.
We're going through school. And did you ever think you would be a stuntman? And did you keep your imagination through school to go this direction for a career?
The thing is, because I was in Africa with no internet, no television, no phone, I didn't know what you could do. The only thing I knew is I didn't want to be, you know, stuck in an office. I wanted to do an outdoor kind of job. But I had no really idea, the specific ideas I didn't have. I was into sport, I was into experience, adventure, all that stuff. But at the time, it was just a journey. You know, it was not like I didn't have a goal. And only when I was in my like 17, 18, to a point, I wanted to be a stuntman in the film industry, but not as a pilot, because I didn't know you could potentially do that. So I had some idea to do that. But, and then, you know, in the book, I'm explaining, you know, where I went. And I wanted to be a fighter jet pilot, but it was more for the cliche that is representing that I didn't know what the job was. You know, it was more like a child dream, you know, a fighter jet pilot. Or mm-hmm. a cosmonaut, you know, like an airspace man or something. So it was a step by step kind of journey that led me to the to what I'm doing today.
And where did you do in stunts?
What happened is, so I was as French, you know, I was in Paris, and then I wanted to do more filming as a pilot. So back then I didn't know that there was a position as a stunt film pilot. So what happened is I was just working for TV, you know, sport event, like filming the Formula One race. I mean, so many sailing boat and stuff like that. And I was just filming it in a stunty way without knowing it. You know, the helicopter was all over the place, and do 3D kind of shots where you move, that you create the energy with the camera platform, the helicopter becoming the camera platform. But I didn't understand what I was doing. I was just doing it. And slowly by slowly, I went into that kind of flying. And then I did most of the rally race, the Paris-Dakar. You know, it's like the Barra race, but from Paris to Dakar and all the other French race like that. So I did that for 10 years and filming those rally race. It's all over the world. And it was Paris, Moscow, Beijing. It was in Egypt called the Pharaon rallies and Morocco. So all over Africa and everything, I was filming the cars. And I was filming them as a stunt person, but I didn't know, which means super close to the cars, creating energy with the helicopter. But back then there was no name for that position. So then there is one guy, his name is Larry Blanford. And I talk about him in my book, but he's American director of photography, and he heard my name through I don't know who, and then basically he called me and he said, I have a movie to do in Venezuela and I need a French pilot because the helicopter that was based there was under a French registration and your license goes with the registration of the aircraft. So he needed a French pilot. So he said, you know, I heard, you know, you're filming a lot of things and are you available? And back then I didn't understand how that's going to work because it was not my helicopter. It was, you know, a helicopter from a foreign country and all that stuff. He said, no, in America, we have that job called, you know, film stunt pilot, and you'll be basically that. And I told him, but who's going to pay me? He said, well, the production company will pay you. I said, so not the helicopter. So it's all those things that I didn't know that he explained it to me. He said, no, you'll be hired as such. Production will pay you and they'll pay the helicopter separately. So I said, that's amazing. That's basically when I realized that there was a position as a stunt film pilot. And that's when, after I've done that movie, I also realized that as a pilot for the TV industry, the most important thing when you shoot is to know who's winning, who's losing. They don't really, of course, they care if it's beautiful and everything, but the primary goal is to, you know, tell the story of what's happening on the ground. When you do movie work, film work, the way you're shooting the action, that's how you tell the story and not necessarily what's going on the ground, which means there's way more creative input from the pilot and the cameraman on board than when you do TV work. And that aspect aspect really, really interested me a lot. That's when I decided to do the transition to the film work and from the film work to the stunt work.
Interesting. So when you made this transition, what was your first big project?
The first film I did in the US was Fantastic Four, the first one.
Okay.
I've done other movies like, you know, Armageddon and Gladiator in Europe, but my first one in the US was that one. And I did it with my friend Larry Blanford. That is, he did the first Top Gun as a jet fighter cameraman. And so he explained to me, he said, you know, if you want to be really a great, you know, stunt film pilot, you have to fly the camera. So forget the helicopter. So you have to connect with the machine in a sense that the helicopter disappears and then you're flying the camera. And I didn't really understand what he was telling me. It took me a little while to understand that what he was trying to imply is I need to move the camera in a way that I become like a dolly grip, you know, on the ground, you know, he's moving over the crane or like I'm responsible of the camera. And originally I thought that the cameraman on board would be doing that and tell me what to do. But in fact, a film pilot, he knows how to get the shot. And of course, you work with the cameraman, but it's not like, because he can't really tell you go left, go right, because you're going to go a little bit left, a little bit right. Are you going to go up 2 feet? Is it 10 feet? Is it 50? You need to see the shot. And then he can give you some directions, but you know what I mean? You need to be ahead of the game. So it took me a little while, and then I understand that I can create way more energy. I can create way more input and connection with the audience if I do more crazy stuff as a camera platform. Mm-hmm. And that became slowly by slowly my specialty, you know.
So it's almost like a feel, because you got to kind of stay ahead of the narrative, right? To kind of get that.
It's a gut feeling, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a feel, and you almost have to be in sync with the cameraman kind of innately without talking.
That's exactly right. We're not talking in the helicopter. We usually don't, you know.
Interesting.
If he's panning left and then I see where he's going, immediately I know what he's trying to do. And then I go. Mm. And then if I do the same, like, let's say I go to the right because there is a car moving, and then he sees, we don't talk. We understand and we get it.
Have you ever found a cameraman that you didn't sync with?
Yes. We're not flying together anymore.
I'm sure that could be fun because a lot of cameramen are prima donnas. And
well, I mean, you know, yes and no. I mean, you know, most of the cameramen that I work with are people that are part of our team, and then, you know, we're like family. So there is no problem there. And very rarely we use a cameraman from the set but in that case, they're more waiting for us to help them. Because it's not that easy to control the camera through the back seat on the joystick, because you don't see the camera on the nose of the helicopter. So sometimes you don't know where it's pointing it, you know. So we can help big time, you know, for them to know where they are. So it's usually a super pleasant experience, you know. Very rarely I had the guy that's looking left and when, you know, we have to go to the right. But
And what, any close calls at all that occurred while doing this that kind of shook you up a little bit?
Yeah, of course. If it was an easy job, you know, I think more people would do it. It's a challenging job. There's a lot of risk involved. There's responsibilities, there's liability, and then there's a lot of weight on our shoulders. So yes, there is close call. But I would say more I go into my career and my experience, less, you know, close call I have. We prep way more than I was doing back in the days, you know, at the beginning. I have a team that is working with me and we prep, you know. Often I compare that to give you a sense, but if we do a very complicated stunt sequence, like 1 second on screen is about a month of prep for us. To give you an idea, yeah, 4 seconds crazy stunt can be 4 months of prep. I don't know if you watched the last Extraction 2 movie on Netflix, and in that film, I'm landing a helicopter on a moving train at like 60 miles an hour to drop off 5 bad guys that are attacking the train. And really that sequence in the movie is maybe 10 seconds, but it took us like 7 to 8 months to prep that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So more we prep, and then less risk, you know, we have. It doesn't mean when you do the 3-4 seconds, you know, you don't, you know, we have pressure. And not fear, it's you manage the fear, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's there for sure.
I mean, I think I saw that movie, but I think it had a fighting scene like every 2 seconds.
Yes.
Was that it? That is,
yes. But there's also a few helicopter sequence in there. It's just that movie is a little bit, it's special because they're using a different technique of filming called the Warner. Mm-hmm. It's one camera following the action versus cutting. Mm-hmm. And then you are part of the action because you are with the camera. And that's basically what a helicopter platform is a one-er, because there's only one camera filming the action. And usually when they are on the ground, they have 10 cameras and they cut, you know, from da-da-da-da. And that's why like an explosion can last 15 seconds because there's 15 cameras taking a second each. Mm-hmm. And then they cut it that way. Us in the helicopter is like a one-er. It's just one camera. We have to create the energy to get that and stay connecting with the audience. That's what I love, you know.
What's the idea behind the one camera and the follow along? Because, you know, most production guys that are really into production, they want 8 cameras and 5 different angles. And I've always said that's too much. Where does this one camera thing come from?
So the one-er, I'm not exactly sure where it's coming from, but it's basically, it's to connect the audience with the action. So usually if there's only one camera and is following the character running or jumping or whatever the guy does, you are him. So gotcha. Suddenly the audience are with that person jumping and it's, and basically what he sees, you see what each time he's turning his face, what that's what you see. And if you have 8 cameras, they're going to show his face looking at the camera. Now, you're not going to see that. You're only going to see where he's going to see. So you're more into the action. And on Extraction 2, there's a 20 minutes fight sequence in the prison. And that's a one-er. And the camera.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you look at the behind the scene of that movie, it's very interesting. Like they pass the camera, like there's a car driving, there's a motorcycle exploding. The camera goes from the motorcycle through the window at 60 miles an hour. The camera goes through the car and it's crazy. It's insane. What I do in my job, that's exactly that. We are one-er. So we are one camera and we have to create the energy. And this is why as a film pilot, you need to be experienced enough as far as the helicopter goes. That it doesn't exist anymore as far as the experience. So you can't really take your time like, oh, can the helicopter do that? Can the helicopter do that? You need to know because you need to focus on everything else. Mm-hmm. You need to be 90% outside and 10% inside. If you are, you know, not experienced enough or you don't have the right helicopter, you're going to be 90% inside and 10% outside. And there's no way you can do the job that like this.
Gotcha. What's one of the most unique or odd moments that kind of caught you off guard that you remember to this day, like one of your top stories that we might find in the book?
I mean, there is a lot of them in the book that are as crazy, you know, from each other. And I mean, you know, that's why the book was interesting to do, because I never realized how many life-threatening events I had in my life before doing the book. I just know it was full, but I didn't, you know, if you look back, you don't really always remember. Mm-hmm. The brain is making that natural selection. And there's a few of them, but I did that one French race called the Red Gauloise. Gauloise was from the cigarette back then. And I was in South America and in that race, you have horses. And one of the horses dehydrated and was going to die. And there was no access from that horse. We could not do anything to the horse. So they asked me to lift him up and to take him like a mile away to a place where we can, you know, give him proper care. But I never lift up a horse, you know, leaving a horse under a helicopter. So how we do that so he doesn't freak out, how we do that without him, you know, slippering anyway. So it was a scary moment. And what happened when I lifted the horse, it was very hot over there and I basically didn't have the power. So when the horse was under the machine and then it was just a scary moment. So it just, there's plenty of stuff like that life and death, you know, situation. I mean, look, there's so many to tell that you and I will have to spend 10 hours. But I would say when I do the Fast and Furious movie, chasing high-speed cars, that's very challenging in general. I've done also a movie that is not out yet. It's Beverly Hills Cop 4 with Eddie Murphy. There's a crazy helicopter sequence in that one. Crazy. Mm-hmm. Which means, I mean, it was very challenging for me. I was a foot from moving cars. You'll have to see it. And after, you know, when it's out there, then we can do another podcast and I go into the details of that one. But that one was a hell of a challenge for me. Really, really, really tough.
Now, do you interact with a lot of these stars that you worked with?
Yes, yes and no. But yes, but in general, you know, so you have the first unit and then you have the second unit. First unit, they do all the shots with the actors. And then the second unit usually do all the shots with the action and the stunt doubles. My job is 90% with the second unit. So we don't really, you know, connect too much with the actors. Now, if we do connect with the actor, we're usually limiting what we do with them because we can't take a risk to have something happen to the actor. And then, you know, of course, separate to the life issues, of course. But, you know, the film won't be able to keep up if the actor get injured or something. There's only a few actors that they do their own stunt, like Charlize Theron. I love her. I did a movie called Old Guards 2. It's not out yet. And she was doing all her stunt in the helicopter with me. And it was crazy how far she was willing to go. I was very impressed. But by the fact that she was wearing her shirt, really, you know, it was at night, it was complex, it was very challenging. When the movie is out, I'll be able to talk more about it. And of course, you know, you have, you know, Tom Cruise and guys like that. But we usually limiting the connection with them simply because we don't want to expose them to any kind of issues.
Gotcha. You're the go-to guy. Right, with this type of sounds like there's nobody else in the space.
I mean, there are other guys doing things, but what happened is because I'm also French, in addition to be American, even if my accent is not really American, but I can fly in Europe because I have the European license, and I can fly in the US, and I have other license worldwide. So all the other American pilots that do what I do, they don't have the European license, so they can't fly in Europe. And there's a lot of movies like Fast and Furious. We shoot in the US, but we also go to Italy, we go to Portugal, we go to Hong Kong, there's so many places. And then people in the industry, they know that I have, you know, international licensing, basically. And so that plus my expertise in the stunt, and, you know, it takes time. And then you're the guy.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I saw in the book, too, how does a guy that's a stunt guy, I'm sure you're very appealing to a lot of different characters. And I'm sure a lot of people have asked you to do different things that you may not wanted to do. What was the deal with the DEA guy?
Yeah, well, it was a long time ago. I was doing a job in Costa Rica, but I leased two helicopters from Miami in Florida. So I had to take the two helicopters from Miami, go through Key West, go above Cuba, go to Cancun, Mexico, cut it short, and then go to Costa Rica. Because otherwise you had to go all around Texas, you know, around on the America side and go to Panama and then go to Costa Rica. So anyway, back then I didn't have a lot of experience doing that. And because we had to cross from Key West to Cancun in Mexico without landing in Cuba, because we were not allowed to land in Cuba, we put auxiliary fuel tank in those two helicopters. And I didn't know back then that if you put an aux fuel tank in the helicopter going in that region, as soon as the DEA find out that we were going to do that, they immediately thought we were a drug dealer and, you know, put basically a red flag on us. But we were going to do a race in Costa Rica for the, you know, a big race called the Red Gauloise, which is, you know, in the book, I'm explaining everything on that race. But it was an event, a sport event. So we took off at like 5 a.m. from Miami with the two helicopters and the fuel tank. And we were five people, I think, two and three. We took off and then we stopped in Key West to refuel a last time before doing the big jump to Mexico, you know, over Cuba. And as soon as we landed, we shut down the engine. And then it was like in those, you know, as an American, it doesn't really talk to you, but as a French person back in the 80s when we were looking at TV shows from America, and it's a cliche. So we saw, it's not like a Dodge, but like a sport car, yellow. I will remember all my life. And there was like a big eagle sticker on the hood. And basically people got out of that car and it was the DEA. It was like a special unit. I don't know what it was, but the guys got out. They had guns. They were not dressed up as a proper DEA agent with the sign or something. No, they were like civilian, but they were DEA. And they basically arrested us. They put the handcuff and took us to an office, separate offices, the five of us, and then they started questioning why we had, you know, auxiliary tank. And not only that, one of the two helicopters that we had, one, I didn't know, he had a latch under the carpet because that machine was used for drugs transportation back in the days. But my friend that bought it had no clue, you know, that mm-hmm. there was a latch under there. So long story short, that helicopter was, I guess, under surveillance, a soft surveillance. But then when we put the auxiliary tank, immediately that thought, red flag, you know, those guys are doing drugs. Long story short, after a few hours, they let us go, but they kept the two helicopters. And they said, you need to go, you know, there's going to be a court and judge, and you have to prove that this helicopter won't be used for, you know, drug stuff. And I said, well, I mean, what the heck? And I had a race, so there was 300 racers waiting for us, the organization, the helicopter was supposed to do medevac. You know, I mean, it was a big deal. So it was crazy. So in the book, I'm explaining the whole thing, the stress level. My English was crap back then. At the end, long story short, you know, they, I'm not going to say they have to read the book, but it was a crazy, crazy event, like insane, you know.
So what do? You have this adventurous job and lifestyle of work. How about mama? Does mama worry? And what do y'all do in your free time?
There's a few people that worry. My parents worried, of course, but, you know, my wife and my kids also worried. I mean, first of all, for them, I mean, my parents are, you know, they're pretty old, you know, in their 90s. So, but I think now they think nothing is going to happen to me at this point. You know, they don't really see the danger because they're living in France. They're not here. And I'm not sharing with them my emotions or my fear. You know, I'm very light on that because I don't want them to get, you know, scared of anything. My wife is different. She's also a pilot. She doesn't fly anymore, but she, you know, has like more than 1,000 hours of flying time. So she understands helicopters. She knows. She's been with me on set, and she was also a what we call a pilot ground coordinator with me on set for a few years. So she knows exactly what's going on, and she, you know, she trusts, and I'm very careful. And my kids, you know, I have a daughter who's 28, and I have two boys, 17 and 19. And the two boys, you know, back 8-9 years ago, one of them told me, "Dad, you know, why are you taking that much risk, you know, for your family? That's not right." Back then, I was trying to explain it to him. That was my job, and I was trying to do it well. But now he's a surfer, and he's surfing like 30 feet waves with water, maybe 3 feet of water. And mm-hmm. I'm telling him, how come you do that? And you accuse me back then to take a chance when you have no problem taking a chance. And what about your family? So now, you know, we have no problem talking about this. But, you know, I guess it's I'm trying to be very careful.
Well, hopefully we gave people a peek behind the curtain of what it's like to be someone that has a job like you do, because, you know, it's a very small number. Very small. I mean, it's a niche type of thing. You know, where can we find the book, and what do you want to get out of the book? Why did you write the book?
So there was two reasons. So first of all, you can find the book on Amazon. You can find it on my website. You can get it on my Instagram. There's a little link. You can click on it. If you click on it, you go to my website immediately, and then you can get it there. So, you know, you'll find it flying sideways. But the two reasons that we wanted to do the book, first reason is to a legacy to my kids, because as a parents, I don't know if you have kids yourself, mm-hmm. but what happened is the kids don't realize what was your journey to get where you are. Because when they're 15, 16, when they realize that the job you do, they have no clue how you got there. They know what you're doing now, but they have no idea. And to me, because at that age, they have so many questions, how, you know, what I should do, what kind of job I should do. You know, they have a lot of questions and they don't have answers. So the book was to give them a legacy on that and to explain to them how we got where we are, and hopefully to give them guidance for that part. And then the second reason, on my social media, I have so many daily messages from young pilots and from young kids, you know, in their 18, 16, 20, 22, whatever, even age, even 40 years old. And they're asking me guidance as far as their career, the life decision, and what they want to do. And then I'm trying to respond to each of them, but sometimes it's overwhelming because I'm 50 and then I can't expand, you know, a conversation through social media. So I was thinking, okay, let's do the book and explain it to them how I did it. And then in the book, we're trying to give a sense of each time. So there's like 25 chapters. And for each chapter, I'm explaining what I took from that life event and what it did to me and what I use for the next chapter in my life. So it's kind of an explanation for them, so they understand, you know, the journey. It was never about the end goal, because the problem is, I think most of the kids out there, they put a name to the end of the, like, they want to be this, but they don't realize that it's the transition to get to that that is more important than the end goal itself, because the end goal, you don't really control that. Let's say you want to be a stunt film pilot. I guarantee you, if that's your goal, you're going to end being a fighting pilot in Idaho. And you may be super happy doing that. It's just the journey took you somewhere else. But the journey is the foundation of everything. So for me, in the book, I explained that each time, you know, I had negative influence or negative answers from older adults or older people that told me, you will never be this, you will never be that. I never really listened to them. In the book, I'm explaining when I did the jet fighter school to be, selected in the French US Air Force to be a fighter jet pilot. When I did all the week of the selection, at the end of that week, and I thought I did well, the general that was in charge of all the future pilots, he said, he asked me to come in his office and he said, Fred, you failed the test. You will never be a good pilot. You'll be a terrible pilot. That's what he told me face to face. He said, you will never be a pilot. You should do something else in your life. And I was depressed for a couple of weeks. And then I'm thinking, who is that guy to tell me, who I am and who I'm not? It's in the book. I'm explaining the whole thing. But I mean, luckily, I didn't pay attention to that guy because look at today,
Yeah. Well, I think everybody that has a unique job or a job that seems where you can't touch it have probably been told that multiple times. And I think it's unique that you want to show the struggle because kids, the 17, the teens, they don't see the struggle because of social media. Everything looks pretty,
right. Beautiful sunset and you don't see the 200 people fighting in the back to take the photo, But so the book is because we didn't want, we wrote it with my wife, Peggy Noor, both of us. And then because it was not easy to write the book. First of all, we're not, writers. So we use my 13 logbooks as pilot logbooks, where all the hours in there, for a timeline and to retrieve the facts and everything. But the idea was really, we didn't want to be arrogant, and it was just to explain and what did I thought about each life lesson and try to, if we can, give guidance or ideas to those young folks out there. That's very important to me, try to help, carry my experience to give it to somebody else.
Nice, nice. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show. Hopefully that whoever's listening out there can learn something from this, especially if you want to be a stunt pilot. And to check out Fred North's book, it's called Flying Sideways, and you can get that at any place that sells books, especially Amazon. So hopefully this has been a learning session for whoever's listening, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
Just one thing I want to tell them: if they want a signed copy of my book, there is a small library called dieselbookstore.com. I'll send you the link, and the library that is not far from my house, so I can sign those books if they want a signed book.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Flying Sideways by Fred North. Like I said, I appreciate you coming on the show.
You're welcome.
And my name is John Edmonds Cosma, the CEO of Bang Productions. Thank you.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.